Hello, this is Aaron, and thanks for joining me for my podcast. By the way, you can get all my podcasts at my website at aaron.bauher.biz. If you're listening to this, hopefully you know how to spell my name, but it's aaron.bauher.biz, and you should find them all there. I'm sitting outside. It's another really nice evening. Just finished weeding a few rows in the garden and picking the last of the first the first crop of peas that I had, the ones that I planted back in February when it was warm there for a while. I've just finished picking them. The warm weather we had a few days ago, the hot weather, pretty much wiped them out. So getting the last off of them, then I'm going to put some sweet potatoes there, I think, where they were. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about the internet. Lately, there's something that comes up once in a while sometimes it's because of companies like Twitter and Facebook that are shutting down certain opinions, certain lines of discussion, which as private companies, they have a right to do that. It's not a free speech issue or anything like that, but people have come to think of those as places where you can, express yourself. So, they're finding out that that's not necessarily the case, and as those companies become more politically ideological, they're shutting down certain things, and so people are kind of looking for alternatives, and some people I know are working on things like that. I think I mentioned before Gab, which is similar to Twitter. There's InfoGalactic, which is going to replace Wikipedia, and then ones like Facebook, that's going to be a bigger thing to chew off, but that sort of thing is going to happen eventually because people aren't going to want to use a service where only people of a certain persuasion are allowed to say what they want to say. So that topic comes up a lot, but then there's also the question of, what about the internet itself? Let's say you create these alternatives. Well, that's great, but what if they shut down the internet? Or what if they shut you down at another level, at a higher level of things, to where, you've got your nice website shut. You've got your nice website set up, but nobody can get to it. So there's kind of a fear of that. And that came up the other day because of the British Prime Minister, because of the Muslims killing in London, doing what they do. The British Prime Minister was talking about, well, we've got to get control of hate speech on the internet. And of course, officially she's talking about, well, we've got to get control of like terrorists communicating with each other. But that's not really what she means. What she really means is we've got to shut down people who are talking about these things, because that supposedly is inciting them to do it. And so really the goal in it's been the goal of governments ever since the internet really got rolling was to find a way to control it. Some countries like China do control it to a large extent, but they can do that because they're already fairly tyrannical. And their people don't have much freedom in the first place, but in a country where people can buy and sell what they want and things like that, it's a little harder for them to control it. So, but it's still something people worry about. Like, what if they shut down, what if they shut you down? What if they shut down the internet? What if they shut down, this part of it or whatever? And I never get too excited about that, for a couple of reasons. One is pretty simple, is that they don't understand it well enough to really control it. They've been trying to figure out how to tax the internet for 20 years, and they're good at taxing things. It's one of the things they do best, and they haven't come up with a way to do it yet. It's something that so far has eluded them, because the instant you try to do it, it's going to sort of heal itself around that. I'll get into how that works maybe in a little bit, but that's kind of the most obvious reason is I don't think they could, even if they tried to. I don't think they really understand it well enough to do that. I mean, other than just marching into some large data centers and shutting off the power. They could, I suppose they could do that, but they don't have any, they don't have the ability to do it more subtly, than that. So I don't really think it's a threat. But the other reason, is that I think a little more interesting is what I really wanted to talk about. And first I'll have to go into a little bit of a history, but just a very short history of the internet. Started out as mostly a military project being done at universities on military funding. It was the DARPA project, which I don't remember what DARPA stands for, defense something. It was a Defense Department project, being run at MIT and I think Berkeley and Stanford and a couple of places. And the idea was, work out the communications network. And this goes back to maybe the 50s, the 60s. Obviously computers weren't much back then, but they were working on ways to have not just communications between locations, but communications that couldn't be taken out. And so the idea was, well, what if we set up this system of communications where data can be transferred through, it can route itself through different points, and if a particular point gets taken out by a nuclear bomb, let's say, the data can route through a different point. Excuse me. So that was part of the idea. Although they didn't really achieve that right away. But that was kind of the goal, was we need a communications network where it's not centralized. Everything isn't going through one central point that could be taken out and, take down the whole system. We want to try to develop this sort of distributed system where data can find a new path if an old path is unavailable. And so that was going on at the universities. And so you get up into, say the 80s, and you've got that just kind of being used at universities, at military bases, things like that, but not really being used much. People who knew about it were using it a little bit, but they really weren't doing anything that interesting with it. Progress was kind of just plodding along. At some point, it got transferred from the military to the National Science Foundation. It went from being the ARPANET to the NSFNet. I don't know exactly what the time frame is on that. It's not really important, but so, but it was still a government project. And so a lot of people will say, you wouldn't have the internet without government, without the government funding it, without the government kicking it off. You've probably heard the joke about Al Gore saying he invented the internet. What he actually said was that he was something like, that he was instrumental in funding it or something like that. He had voted on some bills to put money towards it, was what he actually said. And which I suppose was true, because he probably was instrumental in funding all sorts of nonsense. And if one of them turned out to be a good thing, that's more of an accident than anything. But so you'll get people say, well, that's an example of good government funding or good government interference in things, that you wouldn't have the internet today if it weren't for the government funding. Well, that's really not true, because at the same time the internet was developing, you also had private networks that were developing. You had America Online, CompuServe. I was using one in the late 80s, probably 89, 90. I guess it was probably a little later than that, but I was using one called Genie, which was run by General Electric and GE, and it was like AOL or CompuServe or something like that. They were all similar. You dialed up to something, and you had messaging with, you could send messages like email back and forth to other people. You had file sharing areas. You had discussion board areas. There was one called QLink that was Commodore only. I didn't use it much because it didn't have a local number in the area. Genie did, but so you had these corporate systems that you could buy access to and dial into. The thing about them was they were all isolated. They were all on their own. If you were on AOL, you could only use AOL stuff. You used AOL software to dial up to it, and then you had your AOL chat rooms and your AOL messaging with other people and on AOL, and it was all internal. Eventually, those services all set up gateways out to the internet so that you could get some access to the internet through them. But at the time, you go back in the 80s, they didn't have that. They were all just on their own. So, in addition to them, you also had bulletin boards. Anyone with a computer and a modem and an extra phone line could set up a bulletin board, which was just software you'd run on your computer, and other people then could dial into your computer and use that software that was on your computer. And again, it was the same kind of stuff. It would allow you to send messages to other people on that board. They'd have member, you know, they'd have memberships. I think most of them were free. Some of them you paid for. And so you could also play games on them, stuff like that. And of course, this was all pretty much all text back then. There really weren't, none of it was graphical, but so you had all these bulletin boards out. There were maybe 50,000 of them in the country or something like that. They were all over. And the bulletin boards had developed a certain amount of networking between them because, you know, if you were in a, you know, if you were in Quincy, let's say, and you dialed up to a bulletin board, well, okay, it's great that you could send messages to and exchange files and stuff with the other people on that bulletin board, but that was pretty limited. And so what they did was they came up with networks of bulletin boards around the country that would dial up to each other, like late at night when the long distance charges were low, and exchange messages and files and things. So they developed these networking protocols. FidoNet, I think, was the biggest network of bulletin boards. And so then, if you knew someone's address on FidoNet, you could send them a message from your local bulletin board, and you know, that night or whenever, it would get forwarded along through a chain of bulletin boards to that person. And so that was developing all along at the same time. So it wasn't like there was just the internet and everybody was waiting for the internet to take off. There were a lot of alternatives out there. The two things I think that made the internet special was, for one thing, the fact that they weren't doing it for a profit. They were doing it on government money, meant that they could kind of just take their time. They didn't have to get something working for people to use because people were paying for it, so they could take their time and train and be a little more academic about it. And so one thing they did was they developed standards. And a standard was just a way of saying, here is how this type of communication works, and therefore anyone can design software to do it. And so, for instance, with email, any program that can speak the email standard can send and receive emails. You don't have to, you know, it changed things from the system where, like I said, if you were on AOL, you had to be sending email between, you know, you had to use the AOL software, send email to and from other AOL users. On the internet, you just had to be using any email program that met the standard, and other email programs could understand that, could send messages back to you and everything. So that was one advantage it had. The other advantage was just the fact that it wasn't limited to one company. Once you were connected to it, you were connected to all of it. And that was really, to nowadays, these things just seem natural. The idea, well, you just have a standard and then everybody can use it. Or you just get connected and then you're connected to everything. That just makes sense now. But at the time, you know, everybody was kind of doing their own thing, and that wasn't necessarily the way everybody was thinking. So it had those advantages. And along about, I think, between 92 and 94, somewhere in there, Congress, in a rare moment of common sense, privatized it, privatized the internet. Because what was happening was people were wanting to get online, were wanting to get on the internet. You know, they had their bulletin boards and stuff. They had America Online and CompuServe and Genie and all these other services. But they're like, yeah, but there's this internet out there. And it's already connected up all these university servers, and there's this stuff out there that we could be using. We want to get cooked up to that. So people started doing that, started selling internet access. The only problem was, it really was technically illegal to use the internet for commercial purposes. It was supposed to be a government, university, military deal. And so technically you weren't supposed to be using it just for commercial things. Well, individual people just paid no attention to that, went ahead and did it anyway. You know, when I started in the internet business, it was about the time this was all changing. And, you know, you just figured, well, you just went out there and did what you were going to do, because it wasn't like anybody was watching what you, you know, nobody was checking on you and say, hey, what did you look at today? Was it, you know, were you shopping, or, you know, or were you checking out academic papers? Not that there was much to shop for at that point, but on the business side, as far as businesses wanting to get online, they really didn't know what to do, because, you know, for them, it would have been a big investment to, say, put their whole network online, or start to put, say, their products online, and then have somebody come along and say, you know, yoink, you can't do that. You know, no commercial business allowed on here. So what was happening was businesses that were interested in some of the phone companies like Sprint started coming up with the idea of let's make a separate internet. Let's make an internet that will just run next to the government one, and it'll be for commercial use. And it was going to be CIX, I think was the name, Commercial Internet Exchange, I think is what that stood for. And so that was kind of in the works. They were like, well, let's just build our own internet. You know, we don't need this one. We've got servers, we've got phone lines, we've got backbone, we've got all the stuff we need. Let's just go ahead and build another one. And so they were working on that. And at one time it looked like, well, you know, if you were an internet provider, you might need to hook up to that so that your customers could use, you know, could use anything. And then there was the whole question of, well, then will the internet and CIX talk to each other? How is this going to work? Well, then, in 92 to 94, somewhere in there, is when Congress privatized the internet, took it out of the, I don't know who kind of oversaw it then, if it was still the NSF, but they said, okay, you can do what you want on it. And so then the CIX project, I think, just kind of got rolled into the internet then, and there didn't end up being two separate ones. So when people today say, well, you know, what will we do if they take away the internet? I just kind of laugh, because I think back to not only the people who created all that stuff and were willing to do it again, were willing to rebuild a second internet called CIX, basically just from scratch. And the equipment they had was pathetic compared to what we have now. I mean, this phone that I'm talking into right now has more power, more memory, a larger connection to out to the world than all the computers and equipment in our business back in 1995. And, you know, this little phone, even though, I mean, it runs Linux, it runs a complete operating system, it's kind of crippled because Google is stupid these days, but you can run a web server on it, you can run a mail server on it, you can put your own security keys on it and pass secure messages back and forth with other people, exchange files with other people securely. You can do all that stuff if you want to. I mean, most people don't do it, but you can do it. So I look back at what they did then with just the barest equipment that they had, and the way we used to, just to get a connection, we used to have to go out to clients' homes because they would come and they would sign up. People were just terribly excited about this internet thing. They'd come and they'd sign up and they'd pay for their first month and they'd go home. And then they'd call us and say, I can't get connected. It dials and then screech, screech, screech. And if you're old enough to remember those modem sounds, and I can still hear them in my head. And so we got to, after a while, we'd just go to their house because it was too much of a hassle to try to work it out over the phone. We'd go to their house. There'd be different codes you'd type in depending on the modem. And you'd look up the modem and you'd try to find, you'd tinker with this, tinker with that. And just the crummiest equipment sometimes that you were trying to make all this work with, and people made it work. And just the idea that FidoNet ran on just little, you know, personal computers that nowadays are in museums, and all these messages were passed around at night from computer to computer, people dialing, you know, setting up automatic late night dial-up sessions to pass messages from this city to that city, and then that city to the next city, and so on. So I think back to how they did that, and I think if someone today just threw a switch and shut down the internet, it wouldn't take us that long to just build a new one. You know, it would be a hassle, there's no question, and it would be a major, you know, it would be a major kink in things for a while until it happened. But at the same time, what we built to replace it would be better, because there's some things about the internet that we have now that are just not very well designed, because it's just kind of the way it grew. It really grew more than was designed in a lot of ways. It's more of an organism than a you know, a well planned out project. But, you know, if we were designing it now, we would have a lot more built-in end-to-end security by default. Protocols would be better. The web protocol is terrible. Things like that. So, you know, I don't know how long it would take. I don't think it would take a year. I think it would be faster than that. But my conclusion is, it's not possible anymore to shut down the internet. Not in a country where you have a lot of innovative people who have, you know, these devices that all have just amazing capabilities. You know, we use the internet because it's incredibly convenient. You know, that's why right now, you know, I finish this, you know, I'll finish this and take it inside and I'll upload it, you know, across the internet to my website. But, you know, we use it, and it wiped out everything else. You know, it wiped out America Online and CompuServe and most of the bulletin boards, because it was just so easy, and because everybody was on it, it was the place to be. But that doesn't mean it can't be replaced. And I think if it were shut down, I think it would be replaced a lot faster than anyone expects, and probably with something better. And something that couldn't be shut down again, because if you designed it so that everybody's phone walking around, everybody that said, hey, I'd like to be part of the internet, automatically became a hub that data could go through, and if data was all secured end-to-end so that you didn't have to worry what hubs it went through, that would be something that couldn't ever be shut down without going around and taking phones and things away from people one by one. So that's my take on it anyway. If you want to take from somebody who's kind of in that sort of a business, is I don't really think there's anything to worry about on that score. They could certainly make things inconvenient, but if any attempt to actually shut down online communications is probably 20 years too late. I don't think we would take it for very long. So that's my talk for tonight. And I'll be back in a day or two with another one. Thanks for listening.